Hello, I'm Mary Brett, the resident doer of things. Thank you for being here. At the Doers of Things, we intend to share conversations with you that demystify the creative process and humanize the journey, which are just fancy ways of saying we hope you get inspired to go out and do the things that bring you joy after hearing a fellow human share how and why they do what they do. We're all innate creators curating our reality with every thought, word, and action. My guests all have different stories, backgrounds, and passions, but the one thing they hold in common is that they do the things that nurture the reality they want to live. They all just started somewhere and kept doing. Today we're going to share a conversation had with a songwriter, Slade Cleaves. But first, I want to let you know that this is a value for value, pay what you wish, give what you can, free will investment model listening experience. That means you get to choose what you contribute in time, talent, or treasure to reflect the amount of value you get from listening to the Doers of Things. No donation is too small, and all donations help produce the show. Head over to thedoersofthings.com to learn more in the Donate tab. Slade Cleaves is from the state of Maine, but he's lived in Texas long enough to be claimed as one of Texas's finest songwriters. Like many musicians looking to make it, Slade moved to Austin, Texas in the early 90s, working his way up the echelon of Texas troubadours. Now he and his wife run the label Candy House Media and live outside of Austin in the Texas Hill Country. Slade was kind enough to sit down with me on a windy day at Fisher House Concerts in Fisher, Texas on April 30th, 2023. Listen as we take a stroll from day one, busking in Cork, Ireland in 1985, having never really written a song, to now as one of the most respected songwriters in Texas and afar.
So I want you to start us off by taking us back to, if you would, November 18th, 1985.
You've read my bio.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did a lot. There's going to be a couple obscure questions that pop up.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
I don't know where that is on the internet, but...
It's in a couple of different places. Yeah. I did lots of deep diving. Yeah. So paint us the picture of November 18th, 1985.
Well, that's a date I set for myself to begin my career as a singer-songwriter. In the previous 2 years, I had had a college girlfriend who decided that it would be a great adventure if she and I went to Ireland for a junior year abroad program, college year abroad, to Cork, Ireland, where her family's from. Grandparents. I thought that was a great idea. I love you too, Van Morrison. You know,
so why not?
Yeah, sure. I was in love. So as the summer of 85 approached, I was kind of dumb and naive and didn't pick up the signals that she didn't really want me to go.
Oops.
But I went anyway because I was planning on it, and she kind of told me on the plane to stop being so stupid. She basically dumped me on the plane to Ireland. And so I end up in Cork, Ireland in October of 1985 with no girlfriend, no friends, no family, no car, no phone, no TV, no job, nothing. But a guitar that I was just learning how to play and a suitcase full of cassettes that I made from my records and my parents' records from the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know. A lot of, like, elemental rock and roll and country music like Buddy Holly and Hank Williams and Johnny Cash, which is what I was getting into sort of secondhand through the heroes of my teenage youth, heroes like Bruce Springsteen and The Clash, and just learning about their influences and kind of going backwards in time and digging into the foundations of country and rock and roll. And I got to my little bedsit in Cork, Ireland in the fall of 85, and I said, it was the anniversary of the girlfriend.
Okay.
The one our first date, I think, was November 18th. So in October, I set that date as my goal to work up the courage to stand out on the street corners of Cork, Ireland, and perform as a singer-songwriter for the first time. I had played keyboards in bands in high school and college, and even in one band, did a little bit of singing. But I never strapped on a guitar and played and been like the guy.
Yeah.
So, November 18th, I grabbed my guitar. I walked into City Center, Cork, and I set up my pitch. That's what they call it. My little case in front of me in a little alcove on a pedestrian street. And I sang my little broken heart out for 2 or 3 hours and made, used to keep a record how much I made, maybe 8 pounds or something like that, which is enough for a pint and some chips on the way home. and I was off to the races. I thought that busking would be the best way for me to first learn how to sing and play, because I wasn't subjecting a captive audience to my amateur hour. Because in Cork, especially, there were a lot of buskers on the street. It was very casual. You know, people would just walk by and throw a few shillings in. Back then, it was before the euro. Some shillings and a couple of pounds. And it worked out great. I learned how to project my voice into the city streets, and I learned a repertoire of songs. In the previous month, I set myself the goal to learn a song a day for 30 days. So I had 30 songs in my repertoire. And that's I could never do that today. But back then, I was 20 years old, so I had the agile mind that could do that, and I didn't have any distractions, as I mentioned before. It was nothing but a little tiny bedsit all by myself, my guitar and some cassettes. And the school year in Ireland at that time started out notoriously slowly, so there wasn't a lot of schoolwork even.
Okay.
It would be later schoolwork before exams, you know, later on in the semester, but I had a lot of time on my hands. And so I learned a song a day, and it was Buddy Holly and Hank Williams, but also my own music that I was discovering on my own. Springsteen and Tom Petty and Tom Waits and The Clash. And I learned about Christy Moore, the great Irish folk singer, and the Pogues, the great Irish band. After a few months, I learned about those guys, learned their songs, and befriended a few fellow buskers. Yeah, I just did it two or three times a week throughout my school year there in Ireland. And when I came home to the States, I continued busking for a couple of years until I found a four-track recorder and made a little demo tape and passed it around to the bars around Portland, Maine, where I ended up after college. And the next phase was to get those 9 to 12 barroom gigs, which I did for a couple of years.
So this is, you know, well before the time of internet and YouTube and self-teaching, you know, learning. How were you learning these songs? Just by ear? You were able to pick that out from your time with the piano knowledge that you had?
Yeah. Growing up with piano lessons, playing keyboards in bands, we learned by ear. It's just trial and error, basically, until you learn what chords to expect. And, you know, it's all very, very simple music. You know, I wasn't learning classical music or anything. It was all just rock and roll and country songs with three chords.
What do you think made you go into the more folk Americana, even before it was had its title Americana, instead of something maybe a little harder, more electrified, seeing how's the music of your, you know, youth that you were finding yourself was this harder rock music?
Yeah, my early bands were rock and roll bands. Springsteen, Petty, Rolling Stones, stuff like that. Well, sort of by default, when I became a busker, it's just me and a guitar. So folk music lends itself to that. But also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I was seeking the influences of my heroes, and it kept going back to Woody Guthrie and Hank Williams and Johnny Cash and Buddy Holly and people like that. And they just provided sort of the building blocks for me to learning the American songbook, the sort of Americana before there was the term songbook. And also just songs that were so simple that I could sort of grasp how I could eventually start writing my own songs.
Yeah.
And actually that happened in Ireland when I was playing a Woody Guthrie song called Ain't Got No Home in This World Anymore on the streets of Cork. And a little drunken Irishman approached me, and just as I finished one verse, he piped in with his own verse. It seemed like he was making it up on the spot. I don't know if he was, or it wasn't any verse I'd heard before.
Yeah.
And that just got me thinking, I should just start making up new verses to all these songs I'm learning. It's sort of like a shortcut to writing your own songs. So I would do that. I had the audacity to write a bridge to I'm So Lonesome I Could Fly, you know, I was young. I wrote three or four or five extra verses to the Woody Guthrie song, and then it occurred to me that if I did that and then extracted my verses from Woody's song and changed the melody up a little bit, I'd have my own song. And that's how I wrote quite a few of my early songs.
Do you remember the very first song you wrote? And is it something that you ever still play?
No, I wrote a handful of songs with a college new wave band that are lost to history somehow. The first one I wrote in Cork was called Don't Say No, I think. And that one was not based on something else. That one I made up on my own. But soon afterwards, I wrote a song called Life's Other Side, which is based on Hank Williams' Life's Other Side.
Okay.
And but with my own experience injected into it. And I felt a little guilty, like I was plagiarizing. But then I read that Hank Williams' Life's Other Side is based on an old English folk song of the same name. So there's not much new under the sun. You know, everything is recycled.
Well, we're all living the human experience.
Right.
You know, so the only thing that's different about it is that this is your perspective of it. But the mechanism is all the same. You know, the chords are the same. And the container of it is the same, whether it be painting or a movie or a book or a song or whatever. We're all still talking about the same stuff, the human experience.
And it's important to inject your own point of view, obviously, but your own experience. But as Woody Guthrie said, if you're writing a song for people, it's a lot easier to get them to sing along if they know the tune already.
Okay.
So Woody wrote most of his songs based on tunes that existed already.
How does it feel to be the first person that we know of that put lyrics to Woody Guthrie lyrics that didn't have a melody yet, and you did that before Billy Bragg and Wilco released their album. How does that feel to be kind of a trailblazer in doing that?
I actually didn't know that until recently. I mean, I put some Woody Guthrie lyrics to music soon after Pastors of Plenty came out, which is a book that released a whole bunch of Woody material from the archives for the first time since he passed away. And so I found, my wife Karen gave me that book in 1990, I think. And in 92 or 93, I put some of Woody's lyrics to music for a Woody Guthrie tribute show in Austin, because I wanted to impress people with the most obscure Woody song. Nobody's ever heard this song before. And I caught the ear of a few people, including Jimmy LaFave, who was at that show. Yeah. The great, late, great Jimmy LaFave. And he was, at the time, just getting to know Nora Guthrie, Woody's daughter, who was just starting to take over the archives from Woody's longtime manager, Harold Leventhal. And Jimmy said to me, you need to send a copy of that to Nora to get permission to put it on your album, because it's really cool, your next record. Which I did. I made a tape of it and sent it to Nora. Jimmy gave me the address. Didn't hear back for about a year, at least. And Jimmy bugged me about it again. He said, what happened with sending the music to Nora? And I said, I never heard back. He said, well, I really think she'd be interested in that. You should send it again. So I sent it again. And I heard back from her eventually, and she said, yeah, we'd love to have you record, release this version that you sent us on your next album, which was great. So it came out on the Broke Down album eventually, I think. Yeah, that's right. That was in 2000, I think. It wasn't until 15 years later, I think, that first Jimmy told me, and then Nora herself told me, that she received that cassette at the Woody Guthrie Archives when Harold was still there. And Harold saw it and was incensed and threw it in the trash can and said, the audacity of this young writer to dare to manipulate Woody Guthrie's work, into his own. Nora, apparently, when Harold left the room, she fished the cassette tape out of the wastebasket and said, maybe we can do something with this. And I'm pretty sure that's how the idea got into her head to start releasing the Woody Guthrie's writings that didn't have melodies out to modern-day artists to flesh them out.
Have you heard the Dropkick Murphys album that just recently came out?
Nora sent me a copy. Yeah, it was great.
They were at Americana Fest, and I got to catch part of them debuting that. Mm. And super powerful. Made me cry.
Oh, yeah. So it's a video clip. It's just really powerful. Yeah.
Let's get back onto your writing process. Before you started with kind of piggybacking off of some other stuff, what's your go-to way to write now? How do you like to write? Is it a structured thing you do every day? You just wait until inspiration hits?
My MO for a long time now has been to just keep an ear cocked for something interesting, whether it's a melody that I dream of at night, try to get it onto a tape recorder when you're still half asleep, half awake, you know?
Do you keep one by the bed for that
purpose?
Yeah.
It doesn't always work, but it does work once in a while.
I hate that when I wake up. I know I've had a song and singing it all night long, and I know I'm dreaming. I'm realizing it's there, and it's like, remember this, and you wake up, and all you remember is that you had the song, but you can't remember anything else about it.
Yeah, so you got to wake up, but not totally wake up. Because if you totally wake up, it'll disappear.
Yeah.
You got to stay somewhat asleep, but still awake enough to operate the tape recorder.
You would really need an analog thing for that. You know, because on the phone, you get on the phone, you got to find the voice recorder app. It turns the lights on and all of that. But if you had just like a really simple tape deck record thing right there, I bet that would be the easiest
way to do
that.
I had a little cassette tape on the bed for a long time.
Yeah.
No, I use the phone now. I have it set, ready to go. But so that or just I keep my ear open for just a story that I read in the newspaper might trigger an idea. Say, what an interesting story. I could turn that into a song, I have friends that send me song ideas. Sometimes they're fleshed out, sometimes it's a half a song or an incomplete song of some kind that they send to me and say, hey, I'm stuck on this, help me finish it. Sometimes it's just to hear a story about someone in my family or someone I know is going through a hard time or an interesting time that I think I can turn that into a song. So I look for all those little seed crystals.
Well, that's a new one. I haven't heard that one.
Crystal?
Yeah. Everyone's got their own little word for these things.
Yeah.
I call them my golden nuggets.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, and everyone's got their own little bits. I've never heard anybody say seed crystal. I like that.
Because it starts with the tiniest little inspiration. And you got to make sure and record those somehow when they happen as soon as possible. And then set them aside for when you have, and that's what I do, is I write sort of seasonally when I'm not releasing a record or touring or doing interviews and promoting a record, and it's time to go down to the guest house for a couple of days. Usually I pack some food and some clothes and just go downstairs and sequester myself in my room.
Okay.
I mean, I used to, 30 years ago, I'd drive to a state park with a blanket and a sandwich and tell Karen I wouldn't be home until I wrote a song. Now that we're lucky enough to have a guest house, I do that. I stay down there for at least 3 days. Usually 3 days works. And I just devote myself to the idea of writing. And I usually bring books and movies just to get in that mindset of language and story and characters. And then it's when I'm ready to, I open up my notebook of those little seed crystals that I've written down or recorded over the previous year or two and just hammer away at them and try to flesh them out or combine them or really spend the time to just stare at them for hours and hours until I figure out what to do with them. Because if I look at one of those ideas for 2 minutes, I'll just get frustrated. What I saw in that. But if you really try for an hour or two, eventually something will happen.
So what are some, or who are some of your favorite authors? You studied English and philosophy in college, and so, you know, you were a trained reader and trained dissector of a story and of a concept.
A little bit.
Who are some of the people that you remember being influential then, and then maybe who, like now, who are some of your favorite people that you kind of go to for inspiration?
Yeah. An early one was James Joyce. I actually got assigned the collection of double letters in high school. And it was assigned to me on one of the last days of my junior year in high school, which I skipped with my buddy Rod Picott. We went to the music store and hung out all day. And it was like a preview of the senior year, so I figured it wasn't that important. You know, it was the only day at school I ever skipped. But the consequence was in my AP senior English class that I would take part in the following year, they assigned an author to every student. I was assigned James Joyce, which nobody else wanted, which intimidated me because I didn't know anything about James Joyce. I didn't know about any of his, you know, experimental avant-garde stuff that came later. But Dubliners, I really enjoyed, despite not knowing that much about Ireland. I haven't gone to Ireland yet. I was just still in high school. Dubliners has a lot of Irish references from the early 20th century, which I didn't pick up on. But it also has incredibly intimate, detailed storytelling that resonated through the years to me, especially the final story, The Dead, which has become one of my favorite stories of all time. It's just a very small, intimate story just about people and how they interact and how people think and how people behave. So I guess James Joyce was an early influence. And then when I got to college, took a poetry class, and Yeats, I was interested in Yeats. I had never heard of him, but I had a really great poetry teacher who sort of taught me about literary techniques like allusion and things like that. What's the one with we reiterate the vowels?
Alliteration.
Alliteration, that's what I'm thinking of. Alliteration, allusion, those kind of things. And so I just... The poetry teacher had it in college in freshman year. It was just so great. It was the first time I'd ever dissected poetry and really not just given it a gloss, which I had done before, but really dig into the meaning and the hidden meaning behind it. And that sort of gave me an appreciation that literature, whether it's songs or even painting or plays or any kind of art, has more going on than what's just on the surface.
Yeah.
I didn't really know that before, so that was a big deal. And I had a really great English teacher as well, an expository writing teacher, who actually taught creative writing. He was just a maverick, I guess. And he saw my first story, my first short story assignment, and wrote a beautiful little note about how I had an individual voice, and I should really look into being a writer, which nobody had ever said before. Yeah, it was huge.
That makes a difference when someone sees what you're doing and believes in it and shares that recognition with you instead of just keeping it to themselves.
Yeah. So that was really helpful. And then, who else was a big influence was Joseph Campbell. I came across his book right after college and just learning about myth and how universal those mythic themes are of the heroes and the struggles and stuff.
Did reading it of him not only influence your work, but your own personal human journey?
I think so, yeah, sure. It helped me put things in context. And it helped, reading those books, it just helps me sort of connect to the universal, the human universal, because that's what songwriting is all about, I think, is to connect to people through the song,
You're definitely doing that. You're a writer who is more telling, other people's stories than writing autobiographical things that you're going through.
Right.
Do you feel that you have a responsibility to your listeners and to the people that you're telling stories of that are not something that you've lived through? And if so, how do you honor that?
Well, I think in my early years of writing, I was mostly just drawing on my own experience, my own emotions, trauma I would go through with a breakup or something like that. And I think somewhere along the line, maybe after a few years in Austin, where I struggled to find an audience, I had a little bit of success here and there, but I just came to the realization that it's more important to tell someone else's story than to tell my story. It comes from...
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's an idea that evolved with me. It may have been inspired by Woody Guthrie, who said, let me be the guy who told you what you already knew.
Oh,
and that was mysterious to me, but I thought about it a lot, and I sort of modified it to my own use for my own philosophy, which became, it's not up to me to tell my story. It's up to me to tell your story. It's up to me to articulate what you're going through. That's how you connect with people. Now, some artists, they tell their own story assuming that their experience will be shared by other people. And I understand that, and that's valid too, of course.
Yeah.
But it's helpful for me to really put myself in someone else's shoes and say, I'm going to connect with this person because I'm going to articulate what they're going through. And I saw the results of that. For the last 20 years, people come to my shows and say, that's my story,
Yeah.
And I wrote a song about returning veterans, and I did a lot of research on it to try to get it right because I have no first-hand experience in the military. But I found some good material to study, and I wrote a song called Still Fighting the War. And I've had soldiers and therapists come up and say, you know, how did you know that? You know, that's exactly, that resonates with those people. That resonates with me. And that's just like the best, you know, that's the best feeling in the world to know that your song is connected to somebody.
How do you handle that super powerful moment when you know that what you're writing is really helping people in their deepest valleys? And when they come up, you know, and tell you that, what does that ever get too heavy for you? What do you do to self-care to like make sure that it doesn't become too overwhelming?
It never has become too overwhelming. It's just a moment of deep, deep gratitude that I feel that I made a connection, that I did something good in the world, that my song did some good. It did some good in the world, and that these people are letting me know that. You know, I appreciate them so much for coming to me and saying that. So it's one of my favorite moments of life is to hear a story like that.
So you've got some songs that, you know, I mean, I think it might be fair to say that your sophomore album and junior album were some of your strongest ones that really made your mark. Mm-hmm. Instead of the sophomore album killing your career, it really boosted yours up.
Right.
Do you hold that as your standard? You know, looking, and can I recreate that? Or have you just let that go and each album is, you let it be its own thing?
Well, I had made, let's see, 4 albums, 3 on my own, and then 1 with a record label, No Angel Knows, in 1997, and then broke down in 2000. A lot of people think that's my first album because that's the first one they heard.
Right.
But I've been making records for 10 years.
I suppose
that.
Sophomore, as far as with a record label stuff and not self-released.
Well, that's hard too because the first round of record was 97 and that didn't get heard by many people. So which one do you call the sophomore?
Oh, it broke down.
Okay. Because No Angel was the first album.
Right.
The first label album.
Yeah.
I remember reading something about The Clash when I was a teenager about how they wanted each record to be 10 times better than the previous record. And for my first 4 records, I think that was true. Every record was a leap in sophistication and quality, I think. Leading to Broke Down, which was a lot better than No Angel Knows. No, Broke Down came out in 2000, and that was written in desperation. I had been trying to do this for 10 years or so, with my wife Karen supporting me with 3 day jobs and me doing odd jobs and medical research experiments for money and all sorts of bizarre odd jobs, and going into debt with credit cards and family and friends. And in 1999, when I was working on Broke Down, it kind of felt like this is the last chance, you know. If this doesn't, things don't happen with this record, I'm 30 years old, I'm 35 years old, I'm going to have to find something else to do.
Yeah.
And that was horrifying to me because I burned all my bridges as far as career options, you know, when I
and you got a
philosophy degree.
and you got a taste of what it could be to make music and that be what you do.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, your soul is being, your cup's being filled all the time and not being sucked out by some corporate overlord.
Right. That's
true.
Know? Yeah. So, the Broke Down record, I put everything I had into the writing and the recording and the promotion. And I had the label behind me and I had a little bit of momentum and it clicked, you know. The song Broke Down got on some radio stations around the country in a big way, not just every Sunday of the Americana show. It was like 3 times a day on some big stations in New York and in Austin and Seattle and all over the place. And that made a huge difference. In early 2000, I was playing for 6 or 8 people. And by the end of the year, I was playing in my hometown in Austin and nowhere else except Maine, where I used to do bar gigs. But by the end of the year, I was playing for 75 or 100 people in towns all over the country. And that's when my career changed. It's when my career began. You know, it was an expensive hobby before that. And so the Broke Down record did become sort of my trademark and also my standard to try to match or beat for the next 23 years. And so I was very intimidated when the first record after broke down. It's called Wishbones, and I was writing...
Another great one.
Well, thank you. It was really hard because Broke Down was such a success in my little world that the pressure was on to,
right.
to meet it, you know? Like every song, like if I wrote a workplace disaster song, it had to be as good as Breakfast in Hell, which is it was hard to do. You
yeah.
know? I wrote a song about a jockey, a song called Quick as Dreams. Didn't quite rise to the level of Breakfast in Hell, but I remember thinking, I can't just do Broke Down again. I have to do something different.
Yeah.
And what I thought of was that for Wishbones, I wrote the best songs I could over the previous intervening 3 years. And I thought what Broke Down didn't have was sort of a band feel. It was all done in a kind of a folky way where I played the songs to a click track and Earth Morlick's the producer would add some guitar, add some bass, maybe bring a drummer in or percussion and build it up from a solo performance. Whereas with Wishbones, I wanted to get a band in the studio and record with a band with a little more muscle to it. So that's what Wishbones has going for it, more of a rockin' band feel,
right.
which was exciting and fun for me. And I went out on the road with a band after that, but it didn't have the commercial. It did okay, but it didn't have that 10 times better success that Broke Down had. You know, it didn't have that exponential change in my audience. I'm just sort of coasting
kept
since
going.
Then.
Yeah.
yeah. And so it soon became apparent that I couldn't afford a full band on the road, so I went back to doing the solo or duo. Right?
The last time I think I got to see you live was at Camp Street Cafe in Crockett,
oh,
Texas.
Oh, wow. Cool
yeah,
price.
For the Everything You Love Will Be Taken Away.
Okay.
You're supporting that album.
Yep.
But let's talk about your album that you've got out now.
Great.
What made that different? And how do you feel about it? Talking about how you've looked at Broke Down as the thing you kind of match things with.
Right.
How do you feel you've done here?
You know, honestly, with every record since Broke Down, when I finish the songs and when I finish the recording, I honestly think, yeah, this is as good as Broke Down. I mean, the audience doesn't agree with me, but I feel like, well, first of all, at the end of Broke Down, when I finished the recording with Garth Morlocks, I remember being almost frightened and shocked because I thought, I've finally done the album that I've been trying to make for 10 years, and I've done the best I can to make that happen. You know?
Yeah.
Like the previous records, I wasn't quite sure about. But with Broke Down, I was sure, like, this is the best I can possibly do. And I've felt that on every record since. But I've not broadened my audience much. I've sort of found my audience and maintained my audience, and I'm thankful for that. But I think I reached my creative potential with Broke Down, and I've just been maintaining that sense. I haven't grown much of an artist. I feel good about what I'm writing and recording, but I'm not growing into new areas, really.
Where would you like to see yourself grow into? The Moxie Men or Magic Rats?
Right.
Or even back. Cool Beans? You do
cool
a bluegrass album?
Ah, you've really done your research. No, I think I've realized that I have a limited skill set, and I've done best I can with that skill set as far as writing and singing. I'm really, really lucky that I found an audience 23 years ago, and the audience has stuck with me all these years.
Well, you keep cranking out the things we fell in love with, so
yeah.
It's easy to stick around.
Yeah. It's nice to hear. Yeah.
So let's talk just, we're coming kind of towards the end, but you've been able to see the industry grow and change in lots of different ways in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah.
You know, from being introduced to Napster and not thinking that it would matter, and then now we've got Spotify and all these streaming things, and you know, you make your money by going on the road, getting your ticket sales and merch sales, but now as things are changing as far as less people maybe being willing to go out, you know, less venues being open, seminal venues being shut down to gentrification all over the country. Where do you see it going? Where would you like to see it go? Do you have any ideas about other ways that musicians can have a stable financial return on what they're doing instead of being souvenir salespeople? Right. You know, like what are your ideas of that? Are you just letting it come and just adapt to what you can?
I try to keep up on the developments, but I'm always behind, you know. And I just think it. I've resolved that. It's just the music industry is always going to change. I mean, I ran into somebody who knew a guy who got fired when the LP came out because that changed everything.
Oh, yeah.
Went from singles to LP in whatever, the late 1950s or something, early 50s, I don't know. So it's always been churning. Technology is always changing the music industry. And I just go back to something I came up with a supporter of mine in the early days when I was struggling. Is just do everything. I mean, you've got to play shows. You got to build an audience. You got to get on the radio. You got to get on streaming. You got to massage all those things. You got to have interesting merchandise at the shows in case people don't want to buy a CD anymore. I get it. You know, I remember where we are right now at the Fisher House Cantina in Fisher, Texas. I came to see Fred Eaglesmith here.
Nice.
Yeah, and I bought his CD. Out of support, but I never listened to it. You know, I've got it on Spotify. You know, it's there on Spotify, but I bought the CD, which is kind of silly. But you know, fans, if you've cultivated a quality fan base, they want to buy something. They want to support you. You know, even if they're listening on streaming, which is so easy and ubiquitous. I have a song called "The Terlingua Chili Queen," and Karen came up with an idea to make a chili scented candle. It's for the merch table. They don't travel well, but we have those at the Texas shows, and they fly off the shelves.
I bet. Yeah, that's a fun tune, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you. That's a lot of fun to put that together. So just do everything. You got to have your hand in every aspect of it. I think the three legs of the stool are live performance, merchandise, and royalties. As far as the more recent developments, like, you know, Facebook advertising, social advertising, social media, and like TikTok, God forbid.
I don't know if you have TikTok because I don't have TikTok, but I can't imagine Slade Cleaves having a TikTok account.
No. I downloaded the app and searched for myself, and what I found was interesting. I found Breakfast in Hell that loggers had put up, you know, and they showed videos of them logging.
Oh, basically. Okay.
Or
okay.
I showed Welding Burns as a song. Yeah. And I saw videos of welders doing their job. So
yeah.
Workers have found my songs and added my songs to their soundtracks of their videos.
Do you get anything from that?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Oh, it's all automatic. You know, the algorithm identifies the song and I get a little tiny royalty for that. So, you know, I get like a couple dollars every 6 months or so. It's tiny, you know. I'm not posting videos.
Yeah,
I actually just removed it from my phone because my phone ran out of space last week. The newer stuff, I just can't do. I can't keep up with it.
You know?
I'm not interested in it. I don't think my fans are that influenced by that stuff.
Yeah,
my demographic is different. So
yeah.
I'm just lucky that one of my biggest strokes of luck was that I reached my peak in 2000. When there was really a great, healthy, independent radio scene out there still. It was before streaming, before downloading. People would hear my song on the radio, pull over and write down the name of the artist, go to Borders Books, buy a CD, bring it home, put it in their minivan, listen to it all the time with their kids in the back seat who are coming to my shows 23 years later.
Yeah.
And they're all grown up and they're Slade fans because they got exposed to it early on, so... That paradigm is gone, but I was so lucky that that existed for a brief moment in time when I was ready and I had my good stuff there. So that's where I'm lucky.
My best friend from high school, her dad turned us on to you.
Oh, cool.
And so I was a freshman when Broke Down came out. Mm-hmm. And then 4 years later, I mean, you just kept coming out with these one. And she named her youngest son Slade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
There's more Slades out there.
Yeah. So just one last bit on the technology that changes and you saying to put your hand in all of the cookie jars. Are you willing to put your hand in the AI cookie jar and let AI help you write your songs? Is that something that you feel is okay? And
I've been listening to blogs and stuff, you know, podcasts about that. I find it very interesting. I just heard a podcast that actually played a piece of somebody mashed up, I think, Drake and someone else.
Yeah.
And, like, made a new song out of bits and pieces with AI. And it sounded like the real thing, you know? It's pretty scary.
Yeah. Right?
But I think where AI applies to the more modern technologically created music, it doesn't really apply, I think, to guitar strumming that much.
Well, no, I mean, for your lyrics.
Oh.
Because, I mean, you could give it a prompt, and then it'll write you a song, the lyrics for it.
Write a Slade Cleave song, and it'll come up with something. I haven't done that yet.
You should ask him to write a Slade Cleave song, and it will take all of your songs, and so it knows what you like to talk about and the structures you like to use, and it will crank out something.
I should do, like, a Slade Cleaves workplace disaster song involving hockey players or something like that. See what happens.
Yeah. I think that if someone uses any of that AI to write lyrics or any of the, or a painting, whatever, there should be a sticker, a disclaimer, just like if it's explicit material.
Yeah.
Because the thing I think that makes art of any kind so moving, and the thing that allows the connection to even happen, is that you're engaging with a human creation.
Right.
And there's something energetically that isn't the same when you're engaging with a machine.
Sure.
And even though a human is singing what the machine wrote, I think there's something inside of us that knows that can, or even, you can't even convey it at the frequency that it could hold if you wrote it.
I agree, but what if I use the chatbot to come up with a framework for a song, and it, you know, the song wasn't great, but I thought I could make this a really great song, you know, now that it's started.
Yeah, I know. It's a slippery slope. It's hard to know where, I mean, with me, I'm just like, I don't know. I don't want to touch it. But I can understand how it can be a tool, you know, but guns are tools and looks what happens with that. I mean, like, everything in moderation, I suppose.
Yeah.
But that definitely does worry me.
Yeah.
You know, because I know people that have songs that are written with AI, but they don't tell people that. They say, this is our song. This is our song.
People are doing that already.
Oh, they're already doing it. Mm. And so that becomes, because, the only difference between an artist and just the regular Joe Schmo is that the artist is an intentional creator. When we're all creating by default with our thoughts, words, and deeds every day, that creates our reality.
Yeah.
You know, but we like artists, quote unquote, because they're intentionally creating and that's inspiring to us. Mm-hmm. And so there's something that really, like, waters it down, I feel, when you're not doing the creating. Like, you're not living then.
Sure.
You're offboarding this living, human experience on this machine. And that's just the materialism and the technology, and I think it's far surpassed our spirituality or our even just basic understanding on any level of why are we here, what is this all about, kind of thing. So there's one last question I'm going to ask. So you cut your own hair.
Yeah.
And I have heard that you limit yourself to 25 snips. I didn't hear it. I researched it. So don't think anybody's blabbing or out your secrets or whatever. Right. It's on the internet. So I don't even know if it's true. But you limit yourself to 25 snips. Is that correct?
That was correct at one point. I don't count anymore.
Okay.
It's a good way not to overdo it, because, you know, overdo it, you got to wait 6 weeks for things to heal, you know.
So it was just one bag Flock of Seagulls haircut. And you said no more.
Yeah, my first professional haircut, my mom took me to a barber when I was 5, and she hated it, so she cut my hair until I was 17, 18. And I thought, well, I'm grown up now, I need to go to a salon and get a haircut. And I was in a band.
Yeah,
and it was,
that looks sharp.
Yeah, I was 1982, and I liked the Stray Cats. I thought their hair was cool, you know, the slick back, pompadours. So I told the lady that's, I wanted to look like the Stray Cats, and I think she thought Flock of Seagulls, because that's what I looked like, and it was not pretty disappointing. So I cut my hair ever since.
Well, sometimes you just gotta, you know, take it into your own hands.
Yeah.
Be the master of your own destiny.
Yeah.
And that's definitely, it seems, what you and Karen have done, you know, the family business of y'all, and then especially creating Candy House.
That's right.
You know, so that y'all always get to be together, and you trust the person who's booking your shows and handling the money and all of that kind of stuff. And that, I'm sure, is really powerful as a couple, challenging, but also probably really rewarding.
It is all those things. We've had label help, we've had managers, we've had booking agents, and just they're helpful at the time, but where we are in our career now, Karen has learned how to take over all of those aspects, as well as merchandise and stuff like that. So you hit the nail on the head. It's challenging to work full time on your own business and to find ways to step outside of the business. You know, Karen gets burned out in particular with All Slate all the time. You know?
What do y'all do to step out?
We have a camp, a little cabin in Maine that we go to in the summertime. Actually, we go in the spring too as well for a little bit. And then we just read and watch movies and commune with nature and stuff like that and get away from the internet.
So how many times now do you think y'all have watched Dickie Cox?
Dewey Cox?
Dewey Cox, sorry.
A couple dozen times at least, yeah. It's at least once a month we watch it.
I read that and I was like, oh, that's fun. That's fun. That's a little tradition.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie?
Yeah. It's pretty favorite. Silly.
Yeah. It encapsulates the absurdity of a music career.
Yeah. Well, Slade, thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else that you want people to know about what you're doing, what you're going to be doing, anything like that?
No, just thank you for doing the deep dive on the research there. He found some details that I didn't know even existed out on the internet. So nice job.
There's lots of stuff out there. Yeah. But again, thank you so much for your time. I know you're a real busy man, and I think our time is the most valuable thing that we have. But I think it's important to let people hear the stories of the person who tells the stories.
Yeah. Thank you so much for tracking me down.
Full transparency, I'm a big fan of Slade Cleaves and have been since high school. I didn't bring it up to him, but I actually handed him a CD once when he sat in front of me at an event. While I never heard back about the songs, I was still honored to get a chunk of his time to hear his story. Getting the permission slip from him by not only saying yes to the interview, but then to get the feedback that he enjoyed it, was one of the milestones that helped me form this podcast. Thank you for being here to listen to Episode 8 with Slade Cleaves on The Doers of Things. I just want to remind you of the value-for-value model this listening experience runs on. My current pledge to you is to never have sponsorship ads or corporate commercials. I also have no plans on creating tiered content or a subscription feed that prices people out of the experience of hearing their fellow humans share their stories. All content is for all people, all the time. I can do that with your help as a producer of the show via your time, talent, and treasure. So if you enjoy the show, please consider becoming a producer to whatever level you can. Head on over to thedoersofthings.com in the Donate tab to learn more about how you can jump on board. Until the next time you tune in to The Doers of Things, I'm Mary Brett saying, listen to the stories of the storytellers.